A new president? A new day? Not quite yet.
And I know a lot of you would rather never think about him again and just move on. But the wreckage he left behind will be with us for years.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The press contributed to Trump's mess. To clean it up, what should we learn or unlearn?
For example, what the president says is news. By obeying that convention, journalists cooperated in their own demise.
But growth is possible. In honor of our 20th anniversary, we look back at how far this show has come.
There were waves in the air that were barely regulated.
Oh, the memories. It's all coming up after this.
Broadcast was new.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. So, Brooke, how was your week?
Not bad. Yours?
Busy. Not as busy as some.
Joe Biden signing 17 executive orders hours after moving into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Among them, rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, mandating mask wearing to combat the COVID-19 crisis, and halting further construction of Donald Trump's centerpiece policy, the border wall with Mexico.
A requirement for people to wear masks in airports and on many trains, airplanes, and buses, as well as federal buildings. The establishment of a COVID testing board, which will focus on dealing with shortfalls as well, and directing FEMA to use disaster relief funds to reimburse states for costs associated with emergency supply efforts.
Using the Defense Production Act to increase supplies of PPE, vaccines, testing supplies.
Repeal former President Trump's Muslim travel ban.
The U.S. is to rejoin the World Health Organization and Paris Climate Accord, and the Keystone oil pipeline is being scrapped.
On the economy, President Biden extended a pause on student loan repayments until September and a moratorium on evictions.
This Wednesday, two Wednesdays after bloody insurrection, one Wednesday after impeachment number two, I heard cheers outside the window of my Brooklyn bubble. I mean, I don't want to mediate anyone else's experience, but I do know that the shepherd tone we invoked some years back, that ascending, never-resolving sound of nerves stretched to the breaking point, that ever-tightening band of pressure on the brain, basically the soundtrack of the last 5 years, for most Americans, seemed finally to switch off. A momentary reprieve.
Momentary indeed. On the reality-based front, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican, California, falsely claimed he did not vote to deny Joe Biden his electors. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell signaled that he would hold Biden's nominees and legislative agenda hostage until Democrats agreed to cede some of their newly won power. And President Biden's stimulus package seems to have no Senate Republican support. So it seems the filibuster may have to go after all. Bare knuckles are coming out. The honeymoon never happened. Not to harsh anyone's mellow, but majority rule doesn't have much purchase in Congress. So, business as usual so far.
Meanwhile, we could likely see the COVID death toll here reach 500,000 next month. And when it comes to our social, political, and cultural maladies, well, we've merely shed a symptom, not the cause or causes. Those are for journalists to expose, but are they, up to it? That's a crucial question. Have we been vaccinated against our own unproductive reflexes, blinders, and conventions, the ones that bogged us down for so long? We'll take a deep dive into lessons learned in the next segment. But first, a status report on the condition the 45th president left journalism in. Turns out, being called enemy of the people and scum of the earth for 5 years was sometimes scary, but it wasn't all bad. It offered some of us, especially those from elite mainstream outlets covering the White House, some lucrative career opportunities.
The fact that Donald Trump was trying to turn reporters into villains made them heroes to half the country. I say this as somebody who benefited, however inadvertently, from it.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic. How did he benefit?
Well, when I would, you know, write a story that was skeptical of Donald Trump, I would get, you know, invited to go on The Daily Show. I would get offered speaking engagements. My stories would, you know, be retweeted and travel all over the world. You basically had this huge global cheering section.
You had this great line in your piece that once obscure correspondents were recast in the popular imagination as resistance heroes.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I think, the strangest part of it, right? Honestly, journalists tend to do their best work when they're not seen as heroic figures, when they're actually kind of obnoxious, a little too nosy, and a little bit on the fringe of whatever world they're covering, and they're not glammed up. Instead, they're kind of just these rumpled observers of American life. I think that's kind of the sweet spot for journalism. And so it was kind of uncomfortable when, in the imagination of one half of the country, it was like, almost like we had capes on, right? Like that I don't think is actually where the best journalism is produced. And I think the best reporters and journalists of this era did all they could to resist that.
You quote New York Magazine's Olivia Nuzzi saying that she could write in a piece, quote, "Donald Trump is the biggest a-hole to ever live, and he is a terrible human being and a bleepy president, and like, he's ugly." And no one would be mad at me except the same people who are mad at me anyway for existing.
Right. That's the other thing that was happening here, which is that in the Trump era, a lot of the conservatives who had spent time in the past criticizing the mainstream media for being biased and who had a certain amount of pull among, frankly, editors at Washington publications. A lot of leaders of newsrooms really cared about conservatives complaining of bias. That changed in the Trump era in part because a lot of those conservative critics went so fully off the deep end, frankly, where it was no longer a debate about whether something was biased or a story should have been framed a different way. Instead, it became just dismissing every inconvenient story as fake news, inventing facts wholesale. What happened was that a lot of reporters and editors got desensitized to these criticisms and kind of stopped paying attention. You know, what I think Olivia was describing there is that when you have conservatives who are going to be mad at you no matter what you write every day, you end up kind of tuning out what they're saying and you pay more attention to the rest of the country, which exists somewhere from the center to the left. There's a kind of direct language where you're actually not just trying to convey clearly what's happening. You're trying to kind of preach to the choir. But it's only your audience. It's not the whole country. Mm-hmm. And I think that making our audiences uncomfortable is often our job, right? We have to reflect how they're feeling and what they're thinking, but also present them with information and stories that will challenge how they think. That's something that we have not always done well. And I hope we can figure out how to do it.
What lessons will stay with you now that Trump's gone?
I'm going to be better about not letting the political figures I write about set the terms of my coverage, right? One of the things about the past 5 years is that Donald Trump wanted a culture war with the media, and too many of us in the media gave him one. We kind of centered ourselves in the story in a way that a lot of readers and people out there in the public found insufferable, and I think rightly so. look, it's hard because all the audience incentives, again, and all the book deals and the cable news contracts and the Twitter followers flow to reporters who are at the center of political drama. But we've hopefully realized, I know I have, that placing myself at the center of every story is not actually usually a service to the reader. And I hope that we'll all be a little bit more self-aware as we move forward.
Do you think Trump was good for the journalism business or bad?
Well, from a bottom line perspective, almost certainly good.
At least Washington journalism, not local journalism.
And in the short term, mm-hmm. right? I think it's yet to be seen what kind of damage he's done long term, both to the incentive structure for journalists and also to the credibility we have with the public. You know, there was already a credibility problem. Donald Trump was not the originator of it. But I think it's safe to say that 4 years after he was sworn in, it'll be much harder to reach vast swaths of the country than it was before he became president.
Are you worried about journalism's bottom line? As you say, in the short term, some legacy news outlets have benefited. But in the long term, will people lapse into a general complacency, forgetting what brought them out into the streets? And that complacency will spill over into even more harm to journalism's ability to inform and to hold power accountable.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to expect that to happen. How do we move forward when you don't have a president who's shattering norms and breaking precedent and doing outlandish things every day? When the stories are more wonky and policy-oriented and not so soap operatic as the Trump years have been. Not every story that comes out of Washington is going to be as exciting, to put it crassly, as the last 4 years have been. And it's really important that we not have our business models depend on that being the case, because if they are, all of us are going to be pushed to insert artificial drama into every story we do, and that's not good for anyone.
McKay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic.
Coming up, as promised, lessons learned. Can journalists do better? Sooner?
This is On the Media. This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
Listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now we talk about lessons learned, or to put it more accurately, lessons we should have learned. Like back before the 2016 election, it may have seemed reasonable to assume that some aspiring candidates were losers because of their standing in the party, their lack of organization, their limited appeal.
It lets you in the press cover the real battle that's going on among Walker and Bush and Rubio and others to get the nomination.
When New York Times stalwart David Leonhardt ran the paper's data-driven Upshot blog, he thought it was frankly a disservice to readers to waste their time on the fun and games afforded by a crowded field of GOP contenders. Much better to come clean and lay out what the available data and past history made manifestly clear.
And I think that saying that to readers, without going so far as to saying there is no scenario under any situation, no matter what, in which the nominee will be someone other than Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, and Marco Rubio, is a way to level with readers and to be honest with them about what we know and what we don't know.
The New Yorker's Masha Gessen, who grew up in Russia and who tracked the rise of Putin, told us shortly after Trump's election that the inability of our elite media to see him coming was a failure of the imagination.
We need to start imagining what happens if he becomes president. There's an intricate system of checks and balances that will force him to mobilize things through rhetoric. And that basically means, I think, that we have to start imagining witch hunts. We have to start imagining kind of wars at home. We have to start imagining what kind of groups he's going to start blaming for all his problems and all our problems, whether real or imaginary.
So your advice to the news consumer?
My advice to the news consumer is imagine the worst.
In 2016, Gessen offered rules for imagining. Among them, believe the autocrat. He means what he says. And that mountain of lies, therein lay a larger message.
And I think that the larger message there is, I claim the right to say whatever the hell I please. That's a really important thing to understand, that the lying is the point. Not in the sense that Trump really wants you to believe that millions of people voted illegally. The point is, I will say whatever the hell I want, and that is also a component of my power.
But you still want the media to call them out, right? I mean, you did take some comfort, for instance, in the New York Times' willingness to call a lie. The headline that comes to mind is, Donald Trump clung to birther lie for years and still isn't apologetic. I mean, that's a new tack altogether.
Oh, absolutely. No, I completely agree with that. I don't mean don't call him out on his lies. I mean, tell the bigger story. So that headline is brilliant because it points to the bigger story of his being consistent in lying. The tack in the normalization tendencies to say, oh, you know, all of that stuff that he said was just campaign rhetoric, it's hyperbole, and now he's going to become a normal politician. You know, wishful thinking, simple and clear. We have to believe the autocrat. He's going to be creating this cacophony of nonsense precisely to undermine our ability to exist in a fact-based reality. We as journalists really need to be listening to that. The other thing is that he's actually been consistent on his sentiments, if not on his specifics. His anti-Muslim sentiment has been consistent. His racist sentiment has been consistent long before he even became a politician.
Mm-hmm.
His anti-immigrant sentiment has been consistent. And so when...
Might as well throw in his misogyny while you're at it.
Oh, yeah, we can go with his misogyny. His legitimation of violence in many different forms has been consistent. Mm-hmm.
Gessen told us to resist the impulse to normalize, that institutions won't save us, that it took Putin 4 years to dismantle Russia's electoral system, and it took less time in Turkey and Poland. Yes, said Gessen, America's institutions and its media were much stronger. But we needed to stop regarding our nation as so exceptional. It was but part of a worldwide trend. Turns out we were trying to find clues in an airbrushed picture of ourselves while blinkered. There's a lesson there. Find people with clearer vision.
As someone who's covered racial justice, I find it hard to think of an era where I didn't question official lines of how things happened or what the information is.
Yamiche Alcindor is the White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour.
Black reporters, Latino reporters, from the very moment President Trump descended in the escalators and started talking about Mexicans as rapists and criminals, they were warning people saying there is something completely different about this president. I think of Jemele Hill, who left ESPN based off of possibly the pushback that she got for calling the president a white supremacist.
ESPN anchor Jemele Hill is leaving SportsCenter to head the undefeated ESPN's site about the intersection of sports, race, and culture. Hill made news in September for tweets that she posted about President Trump calling him a white supremacist.
Diversity cannot at all be something that's just like what we do after we've built our newsrooms and the core of our newsroom is together. It can't be that you think you're doing a Black journalist or a Latino or an Asian journalist a favor by hiring them. You need that expertise, much like you need the expertise of people who live in different parts of the country, and just like you need the expertise of people who are different ages. All of that will make our newsrooms better.
Is that anybody from the Democratic side of the fence who's terrified of the possibility of President Trump better vote, better get active, better get involved?
Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison with ABC's George Stephanopoulos in 2015.
This man has got some momentum, and we better be ready for the fact that he might be leading the Republican ticket
next. I know you don't believe that, but I want to go on.
I'll just say, I think that another big lesson of the Trump presidency has to be diversity isn't something that you do because you think it's going to make you feel better and you think it's going to be a nice thing to put in a glossy pamphlet in HR. Diversity is necessary to telling stories that are accurate and that are fair.
That's a big lesson, understanding that the gatekeepers of our mainstream media, often people who came of age in a cocoon of white privilege, are likely prey to failure of the imagination. Another lesson for the institutions of journalism, discard traditions that no longer serve. For instance, the blanket ban on having an agenda.
American journalism has always seen itself as essential to democracy. It's going to have to grow up and draw the necessary conclusions that today requires a far more aggressive defense of the institutions of democracy than perhaps they signed up for in journalism school 20 years ago.
Jay Rosen, a media critic who teaches journalism at New York University and writes at PressThink.org, thinks that's the most important lesson.
So I would like to see more news organizations, for example, declare themselves to be pro-participation, pro-voting, meaning that they stand for the proposition that more Americans should vote. And they help that along by making it as clear as possible how you vote, but also by exposing and holding to account those forces that are trying to make it harder to vote. And I think this is a natural role for American journalism. It's an extension of its willingness to fight for freedom of information and transparency. It should also fight for voting.
Another tradition ripe for the refuse bin, the whole approach to political coverage.
Well, I just think it's interesting that the networks and major news organizations like the Washington Post and ABC and CNN announce who's going to be covering the next administration without saying a word about how they're going to cover the next administration. It's as if it's obvious or...
they're just covering it, that's all.
You're just covering it. Like, how are we going to cover Biden? By covering Biden. That idea that practice is stable and that we don't need to reform it, it's just like a curiosity to me that you name the team, but the game remains the same.
Reporters and their editors should resist the reflex to put the lion's share of their resources on covering the powerful from the perspective of the powerful.
Early this week, Evan Osnos of The New Yorker said something very interesting about political journalism going forward. He said, now there can be space and time for it to begin from the experience of the people on whom these policies are landing. Maybe it should start with people affected by the moves of the power players rather than begin with the maneuvers of the power players themselves.
To shift the emphasis from those who wield power
to those on whom politics is landing. Do you remember in 1991 with the first Gulf War when CNN emerged on the world stage with its coverage of the invasion?
Yeah.
Well, if you recall, there were CNN reporters in hotel rooms in Baghdad when the American bombs started dropping on the city.
Peter, why don't we see if we can make that light go out? If we have to smash it, let's do it. Let's get that light out. There's one light on in our room, which makes us more visible than we might like to be as we report. That was a bomb that came down fairly near our hotel. You could feel it shaking the building a little bit as it came down. There's still more tracer fire.
They were reporting on the American invasion of Iraq from the position of the people on whom the bombs were landing. Maybe there's a shift like that required today in White House reporting.
Rosen says political journalism went wrong long ago when it exalted what he's dubbed the savvy style, the insider style that flaunts proximity to power. It often creates fatuous reporting focused on spats and gaffes, irrespective of why or if any of that matters. It reduces our democracy to a petty game. take the approach to Biden's plea for national unity. To the savvy, that meant calling the innings on his efforts to woo the intractable congressional GOP. His loss was foregone. The savvy coverage assumed the new president had targeted his remarks principally to that implacable contingent. But were they?
His notion of unity is fairly nuanced. He also says that unity is among the most elusive things in democracy. It's really hard to find it. And so if you take that seriously, then simply calling his unity campaign a failure because the Republicans didn't cooperate today is extremely superficial. But there's no doubt that we're going to see that. We probably might even see it before the end of the day. In my view, the savvy style was a wrong turn taken in journalism decades ago, and the price for it was seen during the last 4 or 5 years of chaos. And so maybe we'll see the emergence of a new style, possibly from the young reporters who are reporting on disinformation at the grassroots. You know, they're political reporters, but they're starting from the way at the opposite end of the story.
Now we move from the institutional to the individual. And listeners, you can play at home. It's not just for journalists. It's for you and about you. What lens do you bring to the coverage? And what do you see? How is it framed? What's missing? Who's missing? What words are used to convey simple truths? Every journalist I spoke to raised the issue of language, specifically euphemism.
The R word for racism, right?
Karen Atiyah is global opinions editor at The Washington Post.
Racially tinged or racially charged. Like, no, just say it. It's racist.
Can you tell me about the first time you used the phrase white privilege in an opinion piece?
This had to have been like 2014, probably. And I remember some feedback that like, that's, you know, a leftist term. I don't see left or right when it comes to issues of power and race and oppression. I just see issues in terms of how race operates. And now here we are, and white privilege is in headlines. There's whole pieces dedicated to it. I mean, so there has been a change. I mean, things that were once in the realms of critical race theory and academic thought to understand and describe how race and power and even gender work in this society.
The biggest decision any journalist or news organization makes is what they choose to cover or not cover. Atiyah says we have to reconsider the sunlight versus oxygen argument. The one that asks, when confronting toxic ideas or reprehensible people, do we stand with the view that sunlight is the best disinfectant or that coverage is oxygen that feeds the cancer? Atiyah is pretty clear on where she stands.
It wasn't only Trump that many of us watched in horror getting oxygen. I'm also thinking of profiles of white supremacists. Specifically, I'm thinking of a Mother Jones profile of Richard Spencer, one of the prominent white supremacists, white nationalists, sort of saying, well, you know, he's dressed well, he's got a cool haircut, he's very articulate. Here's a guy who wants to try to make racism cool. And there were others, you know, about profiles of, you know, kind of the white supremacist next door who, just like you, goes to the grocery store and buys pasta, you know, at discount, right? I would see that and be horrified. And it's not to say that white supremacy or racism, white nationalism shouldn't be talked about, but it's a matter of giving oxygen to noxious ideas, because at the end of the day, white supremacy and racism is a violent ideology. It requires the silencing, the erasure, the exclusion of fellow Americans, right?
I love what you said about, you know, these white supremacists, these Nazis, they go to the store and buy cornflakes just like us, as if it were some sort of flip side of celebrity culture. So it isn't as if these white dominated news organizations didn't think that these characters were gross, but they didn't take them seriously.
Yeah, it's almost like this curious spectacle, like you're kind of covering your eyes like, okay, this is kind of terrible, but you're sort of leaving like a couple fingers open because you kind of want to see what's going on. And it was this endless pursuit of like, we just want to understand them. We can't fight them if we don't understand them. And I always thought the word we was doing a lot of work in those conversations. A little too much work. Who is needing, is that really what's happening? Because in so many ways, these ideologies and these forces are as old as the country itself. But the rationale, again, was, well, clearly this was an unheard segment of the population, and the way to defeat it is through sunlight, is to by exposing how they think. Because the idea was, if we expose what they think, it's obvious that their racism is so ridiculous. It's obvious that the xenophobia and conspiracies are so ridiculous, people will reject it outright.
You're saying that's not what's happening, or that isn't what is happening, even if that is your intention when you profile a guy like Richard Spencer.
Well, it's very difficult. I have always likened it to handling hazardous materials. I think largely it's not understanding in so many ways how these ideologies spread. And I think for those of us who are in large mainstream media organizations with a large reach, we have to worry that by even bringing them on air and giving them a chance to air their views without, say, other experts to counterbalance, does it mean that a live interview is the right way to go? I think that in terms of the right way to handle such hazardous ideologies, there should be different protocols. But again, back to your statement about sunlight.
Well, that's the classic argument.
Yeah, but it's also like sunlight and oxygen. Could we replace those words with legitimizing,
mm-hmm.
with normalizing?
Mm-hmm.
With basically saying, this is somebody whose views you should consider.
Okay? That's when these stories come in under the aegis of balance or presenting both sides as if each side had a point when they don't.
Is there a point to racism?
Mainstream media have learned some of these lessons, that some people are better suited than others to see round the bend in a changing world. The gatekeepers and the practitioners now have ample evidence of that. The question is, how prepared are they to acknowledge it for the sake of their audience and for democracy in general? The media, after all, are buffeted by the same tides that have so terrified those who have taken to the streets with guns to prevent the inescapable reality and the moral imperative to cede power and resources to those so long denied them. It's not just up to politicians, but to those who tell our nation's story to prepare America to face our inevitable, more equitable future, and to teach the most important lesson, that it benefits all Americans to share.
Coming up, On the Media considers its past, all 20 years of it.
This is On the Media.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Holy mackerel, 20 years ago, that was our very first sign-on. Since Brooke and I inherited a small, under-resourced program from our heroic WNYC colleague Brian Lehrer in January 2001, we've hosted more than 1,000 shows and hundreds of standalone podcasts. Along with our staff of fierce and curious producers, not to mention 400-some public radio stations, we have walked together in that two-decade-long journey. Although, you know, we did most of the work. We've interviewed journalists, academics, activists, politicians, authors, and here and there, the odd demagogic clown seeking insight, perspective, and accountability. Well, where is your market? And quick follow-up question, what's the purpose of the great 2016 Glenn Beck Empathy Tour?
This is the most remarkable interview I've ever done. And I've done some remarkable interviews.
Thank you. We are, after all, ostensibly media critics, so as we celebrate our 20th anniversary, we should acknowledge at the outset our long history, with varying degrees of patience, of finding fault, such as the moment in 2005 when Brooke confronted the CNN U.S. President Jonathan Klein about the channel's fascination with the so-called runaway bride.
Oh, we've done all sorts of things. Anderson Cooper went to Lebanon and Syria to really chart the birth of democracy there. So we're running the gamut.
Well, let's talk about the other end of that gamut then. Let's talk about Monday, May 2nd. CNN Daybreak, the rundown had Runaway Bride, American Morning, Runaway Bride could face criminal charges, Live from CNN, Runaway Bride back home, Crossfire, should Runaway Bride face charges, Anderson Cooper, Paula Zahn, Larry King, Aaron Brown, all of them devoted at least part of their program to Jennifer Wilbanks, the Runaway Bride. And Jonathan, I have to ask you, does this fit into the roll-up-your-sleeves storytelling that you have in mind?
But we've never limited ourselves to media in search of a straight answer. This was an encounter with an Exxon spokesman asked about the company's funding of climate denial groups.
We don't fund those groups. As the science has emerged and become clearer, we're more committed than ever to researching this important topic.
We don't fund them, or we didn't fund them. You got out of the funding business 2009 or some such, but for 20 years before that, you poured...
I'm going to finish my thought here, Bob.
Please clarify this for me. Are not funding or did not fund them?
We are not funding.
And of course, sometimes we break into song.
There were waves in the air that were barely regulated. They were barely regulated. Broadcast was new.
Days of yore, 34. Rules and regs were then enacted, but were almost all redacted.
Let the record reflect that Brooke is endowed with certain gifts, and I with certain others, like parallel parking. This whole deal, in the various dimensions of On the Media, has been trying to meld our complementary skills, interests, and worldviews without obscuring our differences. For 20 years, like a marriage. Minus the joint checking account, even with a spat here and there. This is from an episode we released the morning after Donald Trump's election in 2016. What I most hope is that we are not all passengers on the ship of fools.
What the f*** no, does that mean?
Either. What does that mean?
What does it mean?
Why would you want to end on the line of we're all going to hell?
Perhaps I misunderstood. But if you wanted to know what I'm thinking and feeling and what we should do, I have just told you. But long before the Trumpaclism, OTM was in the business of chronicling and adapting to a series of revolutions, including the digital one, which vastly helped with the finding of information, but also devastated newspapering. We talked about that so much, we made a jingle about it.
Present and future.
We covered the rise of social media and the communities they enabled, healthy and toxic, and the incestuous amplification of conspiracy and grievance in countless echo chambers, leading to the post-truth age of alternate facts, and then finally the big lie of a stolen election and adjacent poisonous delusions. These last 4 years have been especially unsettling, trying to cover Donald Trump's assaults on truth without howling at the moon ourselves, which Brooke mostly succeeded at, and I often did not. But Trump and Trumpism did not solely define the period or our responsibilities. Only 8 months before the president incited the attempted insurrection on Capitol Hill, George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police, propelling formerly disengaged Americans into the streets under the banner of the Black Lives Matter movement. anguish, civil disorder, and cell phone video had combined at long last to peel the denial off of structural racism and economic justice, laying bare the shaky architecture of our national ideals. But this reveal wasn't, or shouldn't have been, a surprise. This was Brooks' 2016 conversation with BLM co-founder Patrice Cullors.
We are frontline news. It's terrible that it's Black Death that's frontline news, but the exposure has allowed for a new vision for what Black life can actually look like. This is our moment to try to get it right so that in 30 years, my child can say, I'm living in a better world because of the work of Black Lives Matter.
All of these convulsions fundamentally altered the work of the media that we were chartered to observe. So it was all on our beat. If we were to define today's OTM, it might be examining and cross-examining the narratives of our time, which is a pretty far cry from where we began on our first show together. Back in January 2001, Brooke walked with a melancholy veteran of the New York Post's Death Beat, a relentless stream of fires, defenestrations, shootings, and robberies gone wrong.
You don't like your job.
I like it and I don't like it. The thing I like about my job is that it's infinitely challenging. It's a total 100% IQ test 100% of the time. I'll outwit all of New York City and get the story in the paper. What I hate is empathizing with the people whose children have been hurt. I mean, when people are just so stricken with grief that they can't talk and they can't cry, they make this sound, they call it the cri du chat, the cry of the cat. It's like a non-verbal, internalized, anguished wail that freezes in their vocal cords. And that stays with you. It, like, stains you, you know?
And in a weird foreshadowing of the collapse of mainstream media to come, I documented the slow death of, obviously, Modern Ferret magazine.
Will you come out and make a noise?
You have to just wait for them. So he's got his little, he's having a little itch break.
Also, it's a weasel and it doesn't understand what you're saying.
At OTM's birth, yeah, a bit of mirth. But 9 months later, nothing seemed funny.
We have a very tragic alert for you right now. An incredible plane crash into the World Trade Center here at the lower tip of Manhattan.
It's believed the 737 has crashed into...
Things changed, and so did we. Suddenly, and for 8 years, we were cleaved to a project of skepticism and warning. A time when Dan Rather declared fealty not to truth, but to our leadership.
This is a time for us, and I'm not preaching about it. George Bush is the president. He makes the decisions. And, you know, it's just one American. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where.
Yikes. We weren't seeing the wisdom of journalists charging up that particular hill, and so one of my earliest primal screams.
The issue is objectivity and credibility. If TV news wants to be genuinely patriotic, it must continue to be the skeptical voice envisioned by the country's founders. Journalism's job is to unravel, not to unfurl.
The wars came nonetheless, and with them, the creeping incursions on speech and privacy. We did an entire hour on the USA Patriot Act, where Republican Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner acknowledged that the Bush administration took a murky piece of legislation and treated it as carte blanche for a security state.
I was the chairman of this committee on September 11 and the author of the Patriot Act. I can say in no uncertain terms that Congress did not intend to allow the bulk collection of Americans' records. The government's overbroad collection is based on a blatant misreading of the law.
Misreading, of course, can be a sin of commission or omission. We ourselves did not wish to view the world through our own assumptions and desires, and certainly not through a made-in-the-U.S. soda straw. As the years went on, the narratives came flying in from every corner of the world, so when we could afford to, we went.
I'm Brooke Gladstone reporting this hour from Liberia.
I'm Bob Garfield. And those are street musicians on Rio de Janeiro's Copacabana Beach.
First stop, the city of Ramallah, seat of the Palestinian Authority.
This is the ferry boat crossing the Bosphorus from Asia to Europe.
In Shanghai, it's all in the skyline. Colonial stones, soaring steel spires, sagging tenements.
Also Russia, Jordan, South Africa, England. Yes, OTM crossed frontiers, but so did everyone else. Through the internet, our news and our culture became borderless, requiring, among other things, a fundamental recalibration of journalistic assumptions. This we learned right here in our studio in a conversation Brooke had with New York Times reporter Donald McNeil about the movie Black Hawk Down. He had screened it in Mogadishu and witnessed the disconnect of Somalis trying to understand the heroic Americans' storyline.
I mean, the film is told entirely from the side of these fabulous American heroes shooting their way through a continent of savages or a city full of savages. I mean, you know, and everybody's called skinnies, which is the equivalent of calling them dinks or slopes. It's quite ugly in its portrayal of the Somalis.
It was the kind of obvious that makes you slap your own forehead. But it was also a foreshadowing, a glimpse in 2002 of the OTM we produce today, examining narratives for obscured perspectives, especially ones obscured by chauvinism and myth. That approach was eventually to find its fullest expression in Brooke's exhaustive 2016 reconsideration of poverty in America in five parts. Among those she spoke to was a young Cleveland mother who'd lost her job over her need to care for her premature infant and who was reduced to selling her blood plasma to survive.
To have a needle in you, sucking the blood out of you, and then taking the nutrients and then pushing blood back into you and repeating the cycle is very uncomfortable. But feeling sad and feeling sorry for myself is not going to help the situation, is it? Does it upset me? Yeah, it upsets me. It frustrates me, but I am that person that takes responsibility for their actions.
There's a texting abbreviation, IRL, in real life. Brooke brought that home. Of course, the abbreviation is meant to distinguish flesh and blood, brick and mortar, from the virtual world of zeros and ones. But as we have all only too recently been reminded, in the virtual spaces lurk life and death as well.
Jews will not replace us!
That was the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Vice News journalist Elle Reeve recalled for us how she saw those seeds planted online 2 years earlier.
I was on 4chan the day that Microsoft launched a chatbot called Tay. She was supposed to be on Twitter and Instagram and learn from how people talked and interact with them to talk more human. And within, I don't know, maybe 18 hours, 4chan figured out how to turn her into a Nazi. And it was incredible, these guys all working together with this collective inside joke that was horrible.
When we started in 2001, Mark Zuckerberg was a junior in high school. The internet reached about 6% of the world's population. Twitter was a bird call. The cloud was where rain came from. But as we clicked our way through the aughts, the ramifications of these technologies for journalism, privacy, and democracy began to pile up and piled further until it had engulfed newspapers, much of our civic discourse, and eventually even truth itself. When I traveled to Silicon Valley to size up digital dystopia, what did I find but a dark irony and a classic case in the annals of unintended consequences? Back in the 1940s, the computer age itself was ushered in, largely according to the ethos of the philosopher-mathematician Norbert Wiener, father of cybernetics. Wiener, says Stanford University communications professor Fred Turner, sought safe haven for democratic discourse in the wake of 15 years of fascism via the same architecture we now disparagingly call the filter bubble.
In which freedom was imagined as being able to build your own feedback loops,
as being able to enter into the world, seek the information that you needed, learn from it, and then change your action accordingly. In many ways, Google is the dream of Norbert Wiener from the 1940s realized. The trouble is, once realized, it doesn't necessarily bring us democracy. It brings us a new and different mode of authoritarian enclosure.
In sum, our coverage aimed to unravel the double helix of technology and politics in service of our very hearts and minds. I guess you could say, over 20 years, we've appointed ourselves not just watchdogs of the watchdogs, but chaperones on a journey toward just plain remaining honest and free. Yes, not to get too sappy about it, a journey with you along for every step of the way. You know, over the years, you may have noticed we just love Wizard of Oz analogies. So, one more time, here we go. Especially at this particular moment in history, I think of little Dorothy arm in arm with friends traversing the splendid and harrowing yellow brick road, pulling back the curtain and eventually finding the truth.
Oh, Annie M., there's no place like home.
Wait, did she say OTM? I think she did. OTM. We'll look into that. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Eloise Blondio, and Rebecca Clark Callender, with help from Alex Hainsworth. Zandra Ellen writes our newsletter, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Adrian Lilly.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And to you, Bob, a remote clink of champagne. Cheap glass.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.